Hello, everyone. Welcome to the second episode of A Recipe for Murder. Today, we will be talking about the Cleveland Strangler and baking some cheesy garlic dinner rolls. So, I am making cheesy garlic dinner rolls. I got this recipe from aheadoftime.com. It's a bread recipe. It's more complex than really anything I've done before. We'll see how it turns out. It's got a lot of ingredients. It's for the dough, it's pretty standard bread ingredients: yeast, milk, butter, sugar, salt, egg, flour. It's filled with cream cheese and mozzarella, and it's topped with garlic, butter, mozzarella, parmesan, green onions, and that's all part of an egg wash. Before recording this, I prepared the dough, I mixed it, I kneaded it, I stuffed the cheese mixture into it, and right now it is rising or proving for an hour. After the recording is over, I'm gonna bake them, and hopefully they don't turn out burnt like last time. So the reason that I picked this recipe to bake for this episode about the Cleveland Strangler is, well, it's kind of a stretch. I thought of the Cleveland Strangler. I looked him up, and obviously in his name is Strangler, so that kind of means killing someone with your hands. Usually. Not necessarily. He also did it with zip ties and other objects that he wrapped around people's throats. But it got me thinking, what's a baked good item that I would have to use my hands for? And the obvious choice would be some kind of bread, because you have to knead the bread with your hands, and that's how you get it so that the fibers in the bread are ready. The reason I picked these cheesy garlic dinner rolls is mostly because they sounded good, but also because it's a bread recipe and I like the idea of connecting the hands-on approach you have to use when making bread to the hands-on approach that the Cleveland Strangler used with his victims.
I bring to you the Cleveland Strangler, and who was a serial killer in the late 2000s. So our story starts on October 27th, 2009, when Latundra Billis went to the police and she told them a story that concerned them deeply. So basically, she was at this dude's house, right? And she was having a party, and she was like after she had stayed after the party had ended, she was kind of hanging out with the man whose name was Anthony Sowell. And everyone kind of knew Anthony. He was known around the neighborhood to be like a really friendly, kind of open guy. Kind of like if you needed someone to help you with something, then you'd ask him. You know what I mean? Like you said hi to him on the street and everything. She said she's at this party. It's kind of over. Most people had left. And then all of a sudden, for some reason, he just snapped and he beat her. And then he raped her and he tried to strangle her. And that's kind of the last thing she remembered. And then after that, she had woken up and realized it had been hours she was attacked. And when she woke up, she was surprised that she was alive, and so was Anthony. His nickname was Tone. She called him Tone. And he had dated one of her friends, so she knew him, like I said, as this kind of friendly person. But she had heard some rumors that he had a really dark side, but that was hard for people to believe, so they kind of just pushed it off and were just like, whatever, it's just rumors and stuff that people have thought about him. But anyways, here's what I found interesting. Everyone knew this. He had a criminal record. He has spent 15 years in prison for sexual assault, and he's a tier 3 sexual offender, which basically that's the worst tier that you can get. And that kind of means he's on parole, and there's a police officer that comes to his house every 90 days. He has to tell everyone in the neighborhood he's a sex offender. It's like this really serious crime. But here's what I found interesting. This attack happened on the 22nd of September, but she didn't come in until October 27th to report it. And so basically, Latundra, she was like a lot of people in her neighborhood. This was not a nice area to be in. She was addicted to crack. And so her whole life basically revolved around this addiction. So her schedule was pretty unpredictable. And so for the police, they couldn't find her, and she just didn't reach out for help. And then, like I said, she came in on the 27th And 2 days later, the police have a search warrant on the 29th, to search Anthony's house. And so it's kind of like a big deal. Everyone kind of pulls up. You got SWAT, you have sex crime detectives. And so what they're trying to find is her pink sweater, which corroborates her story, basically says that she's been there, and the extension cord that she says he tried to strangle her with. First, how I should describe it to Anthony's house. He lived in it. He's pretty small, but it's three stories. It's like small, it's like skinny, but it's three stories tall. Anthony's stepmom, she owned the whole house, and she lived on the first floor. But at this time, she was in pretty bad health, so she was kind of in hospice. She wasn't living there. And then Anthony lived on the second and third floor. Which sounds like a lot of area, but if you look up the house, it's pretty small. Like, maybe like 800 square feet total for both floors combined. When SWAT, they kind of break into the house, and the first thing they notice is that this house is just a complete mess. Like, you've seen those, like, hoarder episodes, and this was just, like, it was straight out of one of them. There were bags of trash and dirty clothes. And I found this really odd, because the house had plenty of bathrooms, but there were industrial-sized buckets used as toilets. And then the first thing they noticed, like, kind of realized it as they were outside, but as they go inside, it's so much worse, is this horrible smell. And it kind of gets worse as they go up the steps from the first floor to the second floor to the third floor. And on the second floor, Anthony's floor, they find a McDonald's bag with a receipt from earlier that day. So they knew he'd been around. They're continuing to search this house, and some of the SWAT, they go to the living room, which faces the street. And as they're pushing this, they realize this kind of the source of the stink. Door is locked. Obviously, they kick it down, and it takes a minute because this room, the windows facing the street are covered in black plastic. So there's no light coming in, it's completely dark. So they turn on their flashlights and they see two shapes on the floor. And then one officer realizes that it's two bodies lying side by side. And they're kind of covered by the same black plastic. So they don't even realize what it is for a second. Like, they're like, they say, you know, hands up, freeze. And so they really get a good look at it. And they realize that these are two bodies. They're not people, they're bodies. And it really, really advanced stage of decomposition. And it's too decomposed for officers to kind of tell who they are, what they look like. But they are sure they're female. Kind of based off of the clothes they were wearing and the jewelry they had on. And so at that time, the officers in the basement, they radio that there's a pile of fresh dirt in the basement and another black plastic bag under the stairs. Police, they immediately crime tape the house, and the homicide detectives arrive, but they can't really glean anything because of this all these bodies being in decomposition. They remove the bodies and they bring them out. And as they bring them out, they realize that it's like a massive crowd has been drawn around this house because it's like, it's just pretty, it's pretty small neighborhood. It's kind of like Cabbage Town, I'd say. But, you know, there's a lot of abandoned buildings. There's a lot of homeless people. It's really not a nice area. And so as they're pulling these bodies out, everyone kind of assumes that Anthony's one of the dead people. Because I mean, as traumatizing as it is, but if you saw bodies being pulled out of your neighbor's house, you would assume too, I think, that your neighbor is one of them. Not that your neighbor had bodies in his house. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so Anthony, like I said, like a lot of people in the neighborhood, Anthony had a problem with drug use. So everyone kind of thought, oh, maybe he's overdosed or something like that. And these rumors and these possibilities kind of spread through the crowd. And it's like, it's this whole buzz, you know what I mean? And so this buzz is like the first lead the police get. So this woman, Debbie, she lives across the street. She doesn't know Anthony that well. She's really concerned about this, obviously, as anyone would be. But she does know Anthony's sister. So, because she just lives, you know, a few blocks away. She drives over to Anthony's sister's house to tell her what's up and tell her to come out, you know, something's happened to Anthony. And so when she opens the door to Anthony's sister's house, there's Anthony playing video games on the couch. And, he didn't know what was happening, of course, because he was, you know, a while away. He'd been gone. And, like, there had been no public kind of statement, really.
Oh, my God.
So she's really like, who were the bodies? And so she's like, dude, you got to come back. The police are at your house. I don't know why. And she convinces him to go home and talk to police. And so they get in her car and head back on the way there. And he says to her, and I quote, it's all going to come out now. And that girl made me do it. Which is, like, so, like, imagine, I can't imagine, honestly, being in Debbie's position where you just, like, hear somebody say that, and she makes instant connection, like, wait, what? Kind of like, just like, wait, does that mean that you, you know, killed them? And so she's super, she's at this point, she's like freaked out, of course, as anyone would be. And so, but she's driving him, she's like in a car with him. And so they round the corner, and then he kind of sees the police and the SWAT and everything, and he realizes the severity of the situation. And he's like, can you just take me, go back? And, you know, she knows that she has a killer in the car, and she's sitting duck. She's not armed. So she goes, she drops him off at his sister's, and she drives back to her house, screaming the whole way. And when she gets back, she's not really sure what to do. She talks to her son and a few neighbors, and is like, try to tell the police, like, what's happening? And then her son's kind of just like, yeah, go to the police, you have to right now. So they do. And so the police go to Anthony's sister's house. But when they get there, he's gone. And his sister tells the police that he left about 10 minutes ago on foot. And she basically tells him what he's wearing. And so they're searching everywhere. They're not finding a whole lot, even though he couldn't have gone that far. So they give their first public hearing and explain, like, their media briefing. They explain what's happened. They say they need the public's help and a $2,000 reward. Happening, they continue to look through Anthony's house. So they take a look at the grave under the stairs. And they're also looking in the basement, and they find bags and bags filled with women's clothes. Floor, it looked like he had dug up. And I should mention that the floor is actual concrete. So he had dug through concrete trying to bury these bodies. Just, it kind of just goes to show you the desperation, I guess. Also, obviously, no one's first idea is to go through the concrete. So where else could he have put bodies? You know what I mean? The top layer of the grave is removed, and they find another woman wrapped up in duct tape with a green belt around her neck, and she has shoelaces tying her wrist together. And so the only info that I could find on the body was that it was in a, quote, advanced state of decomposition, but they can't tell how long she's been there. As I mentioned before, that the smell was like horrible. It was in the whole neighborhood. And so everyone, it was radiating from Anthony's house, but everyone assumed that it was from the next door business, Ray's Sausage, who was a butcher, and you know, it's kind of gross. And apparently their business had actually replaced, like, you know, the sewer pipes, everything they could in order to make the smell go away. But people had kind of just resigned themselves to thinking that it would just always smell like this. I think I had a question before, and it was, if the police were coming by every 90 days to check on him, why did they never say anything about the smell? But I couldn't find any info on that, but it seems so odd to me that they wouldn't have someone checked it out.
I mean, maybe they had the same assumptions as everyone else. They just believed it was coming from the sausage place. Like,
That could be, but like, I feel like a police officer, I mean, not that a lot of them have, but some of them, I'm sure, have seen these decomposed bodies before, and it's supposed to be like a sin that you never forget and you can never confuse with anything else. So it just seems odd to me that they would never have put two and two together. So the next day, October the 30th, they reached out to the FBI, and they had brought in cadaver dogs to help them look for more bodies. Immediately, the dogs go up the stairs to the living room. They found the two bodies, but they go past where the bodies, two bodies were, and they walk over to the wall, and police see like a patch of drywall. It looks like it was cut and put back together. And so they break it down, and they find a giant crawl space with another big black garbage bag and another grave. And there's a body in each, so there's two more bodies. And then the dog goes back to the backyard, and he paws at a patch of the ground which had been like recently overturned. And again, there's another body. This time the body had a phone charging cord on their neck and cloth tying their wrist. So then they tell the public, you know, we found several more bodies, and they, you know, we don't think we're gonna find any more. That was that for that day. And so next day is Halloween, and it's like, you know, obviously a big deal. You won't want your children running around with a serial killer on the loose. It's crazy. And so but the police chief, for some reason, makes a statement and says, you know, it's safe as long as kids stay in groups and don't talk to strangers. Which I think is just ridiculous. And anyways, the police, they continue to look everywhere for him, and they're getting a lot of tips. These tips usually go nowhere, but there's one person who walks into the police station and says, I see a guy who looks a lot like Anthony, like a block away. And so, of course, police head there immediately. And when I talk to this guy, he's like, at first, he's like, no, that's not me. I just look like him, but you got the wrong guy. So the police, they kind of believe him for some reason. But they want to make him take his prints, like, get prints to be sure. So they bring him back to the station, and right as they're about to print him, he actually admits that he is Anthony. And he apparently, according to police officers that did it, they arrested him, he seemed kind of relieved. And he tells officers he's glad it's over. And then the officers ask him, are there any more bodies? And he says he doesn't think so. Like, by the bodies in the house. And he says he doesn't think so, beyond the ones they already found. And then they ask him, is there any more bodies outside? And he says, those two, about the ones in the backyard. And they're like, wait, what? We only found one. And so they go back. And while they're doing this, the police are looking for a missing person report to kind of figure out who the bodies were. And so they're like kind of like found this kind of, not like a style of victim, I guess. And usually it's women that were living alone, or they had some kind of substance abuse issue. Like somehow these women wouldn't be missed if they went missing. And so while they're looking at it, they know that like it's easier to just DNA test them. So they create a command post, and they ask people with missing persons to bring in like objects that might have DNA on them to test them. So Anthony, he says he's willing to help like identify the people, but he's actually quite unhelpful. And so like I said, they actually found three more bodies in the backyard, which brings their total up to 10, I believe. And they find a human skull wrapped in paper in the basement. And so once again, they're kind of like, you know, I think that's it, but we're not sure. And so the search team check abandoned houses, but they don't find any more remains. So that's kind of it. There's no more bodies that they have found at the moment. And so all 11 bodies are black women, and at least 8 died of strangulation. So as these DNA tests are coming in, they start to identify the bodies. So the first person identified is Tanya Carmichael, who had been missing for a year. And so she didn't live in the neighborhood, but she frequented it often. And she had substance abuse issues, which matched the profile that the police and FBI came up with. And then they identified two more victims, Felicia Fordson and Tayshauna Culver. And once again, it was the same like single woman with abuse issues. Actually, Tayshauna, she had lived just a few doors down, and she'd been missing for a year, like I said. Her family thought that she was either going to be in jail or living with her boyfriend. And gradually they identified the rest of the victims, who were Nancy Cobbs, Imelda Hunter, Crystal Dosher, Michelle Mason, Janice Webb, Kim Yvette Smith, and LaShonda Long. And the 11th victim is Diane Turner, but she's not identified until months later, like in December. And so once again, they were all these kind of like, they all had substance abuse issues. And some of them weren't even reported missing until after the command post was set up, just because no one was going to ask questions. Like, it's not a nice neighborhood, and people can go missing. But what I thought was crazy is that there actually were reports of Anthony's abuse, like, before the murders. So, like, in September, in 2008, this woman, Vanessa Gay, she told police that she was raped and tortured by a guy on Imperial Avenue, which is street. And she didn't tell police, immediately, because she was afraid of the police, because she, once again, she had abuse issues and she had mistrust in the system. And 3 months after Vanessa Gay told the police, Gladys Wade waved down a police car and told them that a man tried to rape and murder her. And so the police, they arrested Anthony. But then he told the police that she had tried to rob him, and they believed him. They didn't find her credible, which is just crazy to me. And then the worst accusation before is October 20th. 2009, actually. This is 9 days before they find all the bodies. This woman, Sean Morris, she threw herself out of the third-story window naked, and paramedics found her on the ground outside, and Anthony outside with her, trying to drag her back in the house, and he was naked. And he told police that she was his wife, and they fell while they're trying to have sex. And so she woke up 3 days later. She had a bunch of broken ribs and organ failure and all this horrible stuff. And one of the first things that happened to her was she got a call from Anthony saying that if she told the police, he would have killed her and her family. So she didn't tell police until after. And back to Vanessa Gay, she said that she had been beaten for hours. And as she went to the bathroom, she thinks she saw a headless body in there. As we said before, there was a skull in the basement, so I assume that's where it came from. And she says that she knew that God wasn't going to, like, let her make, wasn't supposed to make it out, but she did, and which that way she could testify in the murder trial of Anthony. And he was convicted on 82 of 83 charges. And so I was like, well, what's the one charge he didn't get convicted for? And that was just stealing $11 from one of the victims. So it wasn't like a serious charge. And then he was sentenced to death, but actually in February 2021, he died of terminal illness. And in 2011, the city demolished his home. So that's kind of like the end of his story, I guess. Thank you for tuning in to Resting for Murder. We're so glad you came. I hope you're going to enjoy these bread rolls. We hope you enjoyed our story for today. See you next episode. Bye.
Bye. Side note, I know it's the end of the episode. The buns just got done cooking, and you know, maybe I've overestimated my baking skills or something, because these things, they seem okay on the outside, but they did not rise, and I think they're like really dense in the middle. So another failed recipe, but what are you gonna do?